Let's Face the Issues with Dr. Jean A. Youngblood is brought to you by First Conservative Baptist Church. Now let's get back to Let's Face the Issues with Dr. Jean A. Youngblood.
Ladies and gentlemen, we're thankful that you're here with us today. We're looking forward to your dialogue and discussion with us. Let me remind you that telephone number is 831-0917, 831-0917. Our discussion today is with Mike Hill, District 1 representative in the state of Florida. We're thankful for Mike and his Christian conservative faith in God and in the Word of God, belief system that is the fundamental foundation that I believe that each of us need to have in order to make the decision of the direction of our vote for November the 3rd. Mike, before the top of the hour news break, we're wrapping up the discussion about the general feeling of the debate and what took place and how it was carried out. I'm looking at an article that says, Biden's Texas director implicated in massive mail-in ballot harvesting scheme in Harris County, Texas. I'll just read the first paragraph of the article. A Biden campaign operative in Texas is attempting to rig the 2020 election with help of others in a massive ballot harvesting scheme, according to two private investigators who testified under oath that they have video evidence documenting and witnessing and witnesses to prove it. With the help of mass mail-in ballots, the illegal ballot harvesting operation could harvest as many as 700,000 ballots in Harris County, according to the Democratic operative allegedly bragging on what they were doing. And yet Biden is supposed to be the clean hands candidate in the race. I am not surprised, but our listeners need to understand that God is going to hold us responsible for how we vote. Mike, let's take the balance of our time in talking about these initiatives, constitutional changes that's proposed on our ballot in the state of Florida. First of all, let me ask you to explain to our listeners why it is so egregious to continue to modify and change our Constitution in the state of Florida.
Yes, Dr. Youngblood. I think that, first of all, the Florida Constitution is too easy to modify. Right now, it requires a number of signatures, must be gathered, and we can go into that in a little more detail. And also the percentage has to be 60% have to agree to it, which is better than it was before. It used to be just a simple majority, and the Florida legislature changed it to 60%. I think it needs to be even higher than that. And why? Because I believe that the Constitution should be a very solemn document that is used to state how we intend to govern ourselves. It should not be used as a legislative device to pass laws. That's what the legislative and executive branches are for. What we are to have our Constitution for is instead to put restraints on government and to list succinctly how we intend to govern ourselves, at the same time realizing that the people need to be free, that they are to be able to have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. That is what the Constitution is all about. The U.S. Constitution is the longest surviving constitution in the world, except for one other. There's one constitution that has survived longer than the U.S. Constitution, and that is of the state of Massachusetts. Massachusetts has this constitution that was ratified a year, I think it was 2 years, before the U.S. Constitution. Now, many nations don't have that kind of stability. We can take Russia, for example. Since 1917, the Bolshevik Revolution, they have had five different constitutions. And most countries have had several different constitutions. Well, the state of Florida, we've had six different constitutions. And the one that we have now was ratified only 52 years ago. So the Constitution is a solemn document that should not be used to pass law. That should be left up to the legislative body, and the legislative body is then elected by we the people, and that's how we all have a voice.
Exactly right. And let me ask you to explain for the benefit of our listeners. I'm aware of it, but our listeners may not be. We have a constitutional republic with a representative form of government. What does that mean?
A constitutional republic means that majority doesn't rule. It means that the majority can rule as long as it is in conformance with the law, as long as it follows the rule of law. That is what it means to be a republic. We are not a democracy, where a democracy says simply majority rules. It has to be within the constraints, the confines of the rule of law or our Constitution.
And so therefore, when we talk about a representative form of government, that connotes what?
That means that the people are able to choose who they want to make the make legislative laws for them. And that is then chosen by a majority. So that is where, that is why we are called a democratic republic, because the and even then, when they choose who they want, it has to be within the rule of law. It can't be fraud, as you mentioned, with the ballot harvesting that's taking place. It has to be within the rule of law. It has to follow the law, even who we choose as our elected officials, as our representatives, who will then go and make laws for us within the constraints of the Constitution and our rule of law.
So if we have what we're calling making law via amendments in the Constitution, we're then circumventing the representative form of government. We're circumventing the fact that we the people have input by electing our representatives in the House and the Senate. They then introduce laws and introduce bills that have to be then debated in the House and the Senate on the floor. They have to be voted on, and then if the majority vote in the House and the Senate is affirmative, then the governor signs that into law, signs that bill, and it becomes law, and it can be modified then by the next legislative session, et cetera, et cetera. Compare that with once something is codified in the Constitution. Is it easy to change? Is it something that is generally there forever? Is it something that would mirror how we ought to carry out and enact our laws? Or is it antithetical to our constitutional republic?
Dr. Youngblood, you said a very important word about the legislative process, how laws are passed. You said that they are brought on the floor and debated. And that is exactly right. That is so important, because even before it gets to the floor, it is in committee where it is there vetted as to whether or not it will even reach the floor. So it goes through rigorous debate and scrutiny before it's even voted on. These constitutional amendments do not go through that process. You don't always get to hear the pros and cons of each one and why. You don't get to hear the debate and to be able to consider points of view that you may not have even realized or recognized that it was there and what the effect could be. And so when we do these constitutional amendments, we are, as you say, circumventing that process. And then once it becomes a part of our Constitution, it is very difficult to change. One, because it takes effort and initiative to change the Constitution. And then going through that process, it can be done one of two ways, either through the legislative body or through citizen initiative. So if it's not addressed by the legislative body, once it becomes part of the Constitution, it is highly unlikely that a citizen initiative is going to take place to try and correct something that was inappropriately placed in our Constitution.
Yes. Let's start with the amendments. Congressman, Amendment 1 says citizens' requirements to vote in the Florida election Tell our listeners about Amendment 1 and the pros and cons on how we should view it and how we should respond to it.
Yes. Now, this one was citizen-initiated. And what that means, when it's citizen-initiated, it means that to get an amendment placed on a ballot, there must be 766,200 signatures from 14 of the state's 27 congressional districts. So they must, first of all, get those signatures. And then it appears before the Florida Supreme Court to determine if the language is clear and unambiguous. When the Supreme Court then declares that it is clear and unambiguous, then it can be placed on a ballot. So Amendment Number 1, which was citizen-initiated, it states simply that in our Constitution, only U.S. citizens can vote in federal, state, local, or school elections. So it seems pretty straightforward. What it is saying is that our Constitution will be amended to say that only U.S. citizens can vote in federal, state, local, or school elections. Now, that seems pretty straightforward, and you would think, well, why on earth, first of all, do we need it? And secondly, why would you not be in favor of that? Well, first of all, right now, it is illegal for someone who is not a U.S. citizen or a resident to vote in any federal elections, and in our Constitution states at the state level. However, there are some cities and some counties, not in existence right now, not there, but who have floated the idea and have tried to pass within their own city, within their own county, the ability for someone who is not a U.S. citizen or a resident to vote in a local election. So this amendment was an attempt to make sure that it is clear that only U.S. citizens and Florida residents can vote in Florida elections.
Congressman, couldn't this same thing be accomplished? Couldn't the same thing be accomplished by having our legislators introduce legislation? Very succinctly, it could be a half-page bill that very succinctly would do the same thing and will more than likely pass out of the House and the Senate, be signed by the governor, become law, rather than attaching this to our to the Constitution. I believe we've had some. I've been saying 127 changes. I read recently we're about 145 changes to our Constitution in the state of Florida since it about 1970, 68, 69, 70. Different writers are using different benchmarks for the date. But let's just suffice it to say 100 plus times. I'm personally opposed to modifying our Constitution. It's almost like Swiss cheese now. So what would your position be for our listeners' edification? Should we vote yes or no on Amendment 1?
Well, because of the – I agree with you, Dr. Youngblood, that this is something that should have been handled by the legislative body. That being said, because it is before us on the ballot, I'm going to vote yes for that, even though I don't think that we need to amend our Constitution anymore. Because of the language stating that only a U.S. citizen can vote, I'm in agreement with that. And I think this should be handled legislatively. I think by adding that to our Constitution, it strengthens it instead of making it worse. But overall, I agree with you that this should be handled legislatively.
All right, let's go to Amendment 2. On Amendment 2, we're looking at raising the Florida minimum wage. Is that good or bad?
And should that it be on the Constitution? That is very bad. It is very bad, Dr. Youngblood. Well, what Amendment 2 says, it increases the minimum wage to $15 by 2026. And I'll tell you why that is very bad. First of all, what they are trying to do is they're trying to make sure everyone has what they call a living wage. that they are making enough money to be able to live off of. What they don't realize and recognize is the economics of this. What you're going to do instead is force those who need the money the most out of employment. What you're going to find is that businesses will not find it beneficial or economical to hire someone and pay them at that rate. So what they'll do is cut back on their workforce, or they won't hire them at all. It is going to hurt those. Not only that, what we are doing is we are having government dictate what a private business is going to do, how they should run their business.
Yes.
We have a minimum wage right now in the state of Florida, which I believe we should not have. I believe that there should be no minimum wage, period, either at the state level or at the federal level.
I agree 1,000%.
That instead, let that be a decision between the employer and the employee. Let them come to that agreement. And if you do that, you're going to see a lot more people employed, because then a business owner like myself can say, okay, yes, I want to hire you to do these things around my office. But if it's at a minimum wage, no, I'm not going to hire you for $15 because I want you to come help with certain tasks in my office. It wouldn't be worth it. So this is a terrible amendment. Everyone needs to vote no on Amendment 2. And we've seen the effects of it already out in California, Dr. Youngblood, in certain cities, San Francisco and Seattle, where they raised their minimum wage to $15 an hour and unemployment skyrocketed. Some businesses had to close. It is a leftist idea that is very bad and not very well thought out.
Yes, and when you look at the ones that promulgated Amendment 2, John Morgan Law Firm, bankrolled. He's the one that paid for the petitions to be signed. He bankrolled this proposal. He's the same one that bankrolled the marijuana initiative in 2016. So my position is, if John Morgan's for it, if I didn't know anything else, I'd be against it. But the Chamber of Commerce, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce, and the Chamber of Commerce for the state of Florida, they've agreed that the forcing of the minimum wage to go up would close hundreds, if not thousands, of businesses and will put people out of work, exponentially increasing it as a result of that. As you've said, I've used the term for many, many, many years, if a person has one eye, one arm, and one leg, and yet wants to be productive, and there can be a negotiated wage that he can be productive in a business and helping an organization where he can get a modicum of pay and not be totally dependent on the government for his sustenance, that would cut that potentiality out completely. And by the way, not just with regular business, it will destroy the potentiality of small churches across the state to be able to hire people that's needed. Let's move to Amendment 3. We've got six amendments. Let's see if we can get through them. Amendment 3, all voters vote in primary elections for state legislature, government, and cabinet. How horrible is that bill? Or that amendment?
Again, Dr. Youngblood, this is a very bad amendment. It establishes an open primary system for state office primary elections. In other words, it doesn't matter what party you belong to, you can vote in the primary, and then the top two vote getters would go to the general election. It is a horrible idea, because what it does is, and we've seen it in other states, where this is open like this, what we see is that there will be some crossover voting. In other words, someone from the Democrat Party will vote for who they think is the worst candidate in the Republican Party to get them elected, so that they will then face their candidate in the general election. It is a very bad idea. That instead we need to have it to where you vote for the party of which you are registered for.
I find it interesting that an individual that is really a proponent of Amendment 3, a businessman in the state of Florida, Mike Fernandez, is one that I think, spent $5.9 million out of his own money. Let's see the number. Yeah, $5.9 million. A total of $6.87 million was spent, and this one individual spent $5.9 million in support of it. And I find that the opponents of that, the Democrat and the Republican Party, one article says the proposed amendment would actually abolish the party primary elections for certain offices and replace them with a free-for-all jungle primary system. So I'm with you. I'm totally against it. So the vote needs to be no on Amendment 3. What does Amendment 4 do? It talks about the approval of constitutional amendments and has a good sound to it. And I've studied it now for some time. Talk with our listeners about Amendment 4 and what's good and what's bad about it.
What Amendment 4 does, it requires all proposed amendments or revisions to the state constitution to be approved by the voters in two elections instead of one in order to take effect. It applies a current threshold for passage to each of the two elections. The threshold is 60%. So it is saying that, okay, here's an amendment to our Constitution, and it passes. Then in the next election, which would typically be 2 years away, it has to pass again. Well, you would think that that would be a good thing because it would make it harder for our Constitution to be amended. However, again, this is something that we don't need in our Constitution. It should instead be done legislatively.
Exactly. All right, let's move to Amendment 5. Amendment 5 and Amendment 6 are very similar. Both of them deal with taxation and taxes. Talk with us about Amendment 5, extending the Save Our Homes Act, as it would be called, that's being codified if this is passed in the Constitution.
Yes. Now, Dr. Youngblood, this one, 5 and 6, were legislatively referred. In other words, these two amendments were introduced as legislation in the House and in the Senate, went through committees and debate, and was approved. And what Amendment 5 does, it increases the period during which a person may transfer Save Our Home benefits to a new homestead property from 2 years to 3 years. In other words, you have a home that was receiving the homestead exemption, and now you are purchasing a new home. This gives you time to transfer that homestead exemption to the new home, keeping in mind that you can only have a homestead exemption on one home. So this is an amendment that, as I understand it, could not be completed legislatively, that it required a constitutional amendment. So any time that is going to save our citizens' taxes, I'm in favor of. So I'm in favor of Amendment 5, which allows those to transfer the Save Our Home homestead exemption, give them more time from 2 years to 3 years.
For my edification, and perhaps for the edification of our listeners, why is it these two could not be concluded by the legislative process?
I am going to admit, Dr. Youngblood, I don't know. I really don't. I just know that when it came before us, in the House, that it was explained to me then that because of how our Constitution is worded, that we are unable to pass law legislation to do this. And I never did really quite understand why.
I don't either. In fact, I've analyzed how could this have a conflict with our present Constitution, and maybe there's something that I am overlooking, or because I am not that acclimated with the terminology, that I have not found. But I'm always concerned, as you and I have talked on this broadcast and other times also, I'm always concerned when we're modifying the Constitution. It gets to the point where the Constitution becomes so thick and cumbersome that any legislator trying to pass a bill has to go back through the index and the sub-index and determine, well, this conflict with our Constitution, and therefore we can't pass this because of that. And the second thing is, well, we'll look at and speak to the issue of number 6, Amendment 6, so that we can wrap up the thought on those two because they're very similar.
Yes, Amendment 6, again, was legislatively referred, and it allows a homestead property tax discount to be transferred to the surviving spouse of a deceased veteran. In other words, there's a discount an additional discount on your homestead exemption if you are a veteran. So what this says is that if that veteran passes away and has a surviving spouse, that they will be able to continue with that discount on their home. And this is another one that I'm in favor of, Dr. Youngblood, yet I think that it should have been done through the legislative process and become law. But again, we were told that we could not, that it has to go through a constitutional amendment.
That is, how would you say, a little bit disconcerting from my perspective. Here's why. And I am just verbalizing my personal thoughts on it. The fact is that with most counties, most municipalities, I believe in doing this, would find that there's a need to increase taxation, increase the millage rate on others, i.e. the balance of the citizens, to make up for the loss that would be found in the revenue stream as a result of this. So my position has historically been, when do we stop carving out special interest groups with special interest considerations? When do we determine then maybe this particular group of people, this particular segment of society, this particular group that might have ailments or problems or difficulties? And I'm not against taking care of our veterans. That's not the point. But the point is, when do we stop picking and choosing, as I would call it, who the winners would be in society? And as a result of that, the bill coming due at a higher rate for the other citizens as a result of it, I am concerned about that. What are your thoughts in relationship to that thinking?
Well, I would tell you, Dr. Youngblood, I understand your point, and I would take it a little bit further. You're saying that we should not have these carve-outs because that may require higher millage rates or higher taxes on others. And that is true if you keep the same level of government spending. And yes, that's where we need to address the issue. Government spending at all levels is way too high. It is full of abuse, of fraud, and wasteful spending. I think if we address that, then everyone's taxes could go down.
Yes, I think we can wrap up the broadcast, Congressman, and for our listeners today by simply saying, as Christians and conservatives, we need to pray, seek the Lord, confess our sins, and ask God to heal our land. Give us wisdom as we vote. Thank you, Congressman, for joining us today. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for joining us on this broadcast. Looking forward to meeting you next time on the air as, once again, we face the issues.
University, 12021 Old St. Augustine Road, Jacksonville, Florida. Located just 1 mile south of I-295. You are invited to worship with them 9:30 a.m. Sunday for Bible study, 10:45 a.m. Sunday morning worship service, 7 p.m. Sunday evening worship service, or 7 p.m. Wednesday fellowship meal, Bible study, prayer, Bible Q&A, and updates on issues facing our city, state, and country. Tune in again for another Let's Face the Issues broadcast. Also tune in the same station Saturday mornings at 9 for expository Bible preaching by Dr. Youngblood. Remember, a rebroadcast of this program can be heard every evening, 9 p.m. on 100.3 FM. Tune in and invite others to listen.